What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
The Bitcoin Matrix Podcast is live with the freshest Bitcoiners on Earth. Economic oracle and political soothsayer, heavily armed clown, host of the Bitcoin Echo Chamber, and co-founder of WTF Happened at 1971.com. Pierre Richard, renowned expert on the investment case for Bitcoin and founder of PierreRichard.com, and the only person that makes Bitcoin sound fun, the eloquent Guy Swan, host of the Bitcoin Audible podcast. Welcome and thanks for coming back on the show to talk on Bitcoin's third election. I am so excited to get away from the normie news and chat Bitcoin. So considering that on Bitcoin's first election night in 2012, Bitcoin was $10. In 2016, Bitcoin on its second election night was $700. And tonight, on Bitcoin's third election, it's hovering around $13,900 and making a push. So, Guy, I'm going to kick it to you to start. How important a night and really the next couple of months is this for Bitcoin?
So I'm pretty certain Peter Schiff predicts that it's going to be zero in like a week or two. But it's not doing so bad. That election record is pretty solid. But I'd say the only interesting thing that has come out of the election so far is that Cynthia Lummis won Wyoming. And that's exciting. We have a hardcore, I'm not sure if you've seen her video of her like kind of like ranting about Bitcoin and like being a holder. But she kills it. I'm really excited. We have like a legit Bitcoiner on the Senate.
That's big.
But yeah, that's actually big news. I mean, I you know, Bitcoin doesn't need politicians. Like, I don't think, like, you know, right. Bitcoin works and it is apolitical. Like, its beauty is that, like, you know, it's the honey badger. It doesn't give a shit. But you know, it doesn't hurt that we get a couple. And that's exciting. I think everything else about the election is kind of indifferent, though. I just couldn't care less. It is interesting. It is fun, though. Mm-hmm. And good day for Bitcoin. Good day. Really good green candle, and we're painting a red wick right now, going right back up. I think next couple of weeks is going to be really happy for Bitcoin.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, heavily armed clown, how pivotal a year is this 2020? You know, is it up there with 1913, 1933, 1971, 2001 and 2008, with the great financial crisis and the white paper getting dropped? Or is this another year for Bitcoin?
Well, every year that Bitcoin continues to exist is a pivotal year, especially because this was a halving year, right? I mean, we're quantitative hardening, like we're doing the thing.
Yeah, I'm wondering how much, you know, does this election affect, you know, United States monetary policy, you know, and maybe more specifically, like, how does it affect the Fed? Like, is Federal Reserve Fed Chairman Jerome Powell, like, affected by this at all?
Well, in terms of minutiae, I'm sure it probably affects things in little ways. I think a lot of Americans get distracted by who the president is and forget how much bigger the American legislative body is and you know, the judicial body. And America is not just the president, but the rest of the world sort of looks to our president as the figurehead, as they probably should. But it's Congress that sets spending, right? And yeah, the Fed that determines the monetary policy. And I guess the president does appoint the Fed chair, but other than that, I mean, I would imagine it's going to have very, very little impact on monetary policy. I can't see. I mean, what's the difference between the two candidates? Like, one wants to spend $4 trillion and one wants to spend $5 trillion, and right, one might tax you a little more, which is strange in a world with a dovish Fed. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Like, why not just print that money? I don't know.
Do you think in like this particular year that Bitcoin's monetary policy or the United States economic monetary policy is driving the surge in Bitcoin?
That's an interesting question. I think it almost has to be both. You know, like, you can't really have one without the other, because if the United States, if we were still on a gold standard, right, or if all of our money was still gold, then would Bitcoin be as much of a, if the social contract of money hadn't been broken so long ago and broken so thoroughly, would Bitcoin be as much of an exponential technology today? Perhaps, but perhaps not. You know, I don't know. We don't really have the answer to that question.
Right. I'm also wondering, like, where are we going with maybe China? And almost regardless of who, or, you know, I don't know if there's a difference in our stance as these two administrations towards China. I don't know if, maybe Pierre, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that my perception is, I don't know if this is fact, is that Trump is much more hostile towards China and Biden is much friendlier towards China. And by China, what I think we really mean is the Chinese Communist Party. And really what we mean by the Chinese Communist Party is the Chinese yuan. So China uses its currency as a way of buying influence abroad. And it's done that, you know, whether it's in Africa or even in other countries with 5G and with infrastructure and all of this. All of this gets financed with Chinese yuan. And the only reason that they're able to really do that is because the United States lets them do that. Now, I think that, that power is also constrained. So the U.S. can't just outright stop China. What can stop China, what can stop the Chinese yuan is Bitcoin. And it's the same, you know, I always tweet about the USD versus Bitcoin. Because that's kind of, you know, first of all, it's my worldview because I live in the United States. But second of all, the USD is still the reserve currency of the world. But my criticisms of USD and my expectations of USD versus Bitcoin are exactly the same, really, as that of Chinese yuan versus Bitcoin. Mm. And so I do think that Bitcoin is going to replace the Chinese yuan. And that will prevent, ultimately, the Chinese Communist Party from having so much influence that it currently has if it can't print its own currency. So ultimately, I don't think that Trump or Biden are going to stop the Chinese yuan. I think Bitcoin is.
What about something like...
I got a question for you.
Yeah.
I just got a question, Pierre. So do you think, like, obviously the dollar has the farthest to fall. And it is the global reserve currency. But, you know, kind of like with this unraveling of the fiat mess is we're watching these small currencies basically collapse in like a series of dominoes. Do you think we'd see the same thing with Bitcoin? Is that it basically threatens the smaller currencies first in other countries before it really starts to put pressure on the dollar? Like, particularly with the yuan, basically an emergent one that's like really becoming strong on the global stage, could actually become weaker because of Bitcoin's presence before the dollar really has anything to worry about?
So I'd say that all else equal, all of the currencies are getting market share taken from them by Bitcoin at an equal rate. And that's because Bitcoin's a global permissionless money. But the counterpoint would be that some countries have a greater percentage of, let's say, you know, Bitcoin adoption than other countries. And that can be driven by regulations. I also think it's driven by culture, right? So in Europe, for example, the Netherlands and Germany, I think, have more Bitcoin users per capita than, let's say, Spain and Italy. And that's because they're culturally, I think, more interested in sound money. And so the narratives around savings and sound money resonate more with them. So I think that that will drive the differential. There's also the regulations. So countries that are Bitcoin friendly can cause there to be more Bitcoin adoption. And we see this in countries that don't tax Bitcoin capital gains. So for example, like Puerto Rico, but there's others as well. Portugal, I would call out as well. they are attracting Bitcoiners, and they're also, you know, creating a larger Bitcoin market within their country. So I think that's going to drive it. Now, I think there's also an argument for the US dollar being the last to fall because it has the strongest network effects as the global reserve currency. But ultimately, I wouldn't, you know, that might be a matter of days, right? It's not like that might not buy them decades. It might literally buy them days.
Oh, shit. Gradually, then suddenly.
Exactly.
What kind of, Pierre, what kind of player do you see China being in the Bitcoin space in terms of, you know, potentially seizing, you know, miners or co-opting miners to obtain or acquire Bitcoin?
Yeah, I think that that would give them a Bitcoin cash flow. But as you know, governments, I think, are naturally high time preference. So they would quickly spend that those Bitcoin. Hmm. So I don't think that that would be kind of something to worry about per se, because the other part is that it's really about who has the best electricity generation for Bitcoin mining. And I don't really see any fundamental reasons why China does. What I think China did have is electricity subsidization that helped Bitcoin mining, and then also subsidizing its manufacturing sector that helped with, you know, the equipment of Bitcoin mining rigs being manufactured there. But I don't think that they have a long-term advantage in Bitcoin mining. And I think that it's kind of a historical anomaly that they have this large percentage of the Bitcoin hash rate. And over the coming decades, we'll see that hash rate distribute globally, you know, according to where energy or electricity has the lowest cost.
Right. No, I totally agree there. And actually something that I found in my reading that was really interesting is that the real reason, or a big part of the reason why China has such access or such production of incredibly cheap energy is because their Communist Party basically misallocated a crap ton of resources into building energy sources, hydroelectric in particular, that they couldn't even take advantage of. It's kind of the equivalent of, I know everybody's probably seen that image of the highway that's like 12 lanes and there's nobody on it. There's like a dude on a bicycle and the whole thing is empty. Like they basically did the equivalent of that for a bunch of different energy infrastructure. And miners basically like, holy crap, here's this essentially free or incredibly low cost energy that we can take advantage of because they built it where nobody needed it. And you know, so they come run in and actually take it. But I agree. It's a short-term shift. This is kind of a transitional thing as Nick Carter says in his analogy, which I just love the analogy, was that, if you had a topographical map of the world where all the peaks, like all the mountains were where the cost of energy was high and all the valleys and troughs were where the cost of energy was low, Bitcoin is as if you pour like a big cup of water over the whole planet and it just fills in everywhere where the energy cost is low. I think this is just kind of a temporary, like, transitional thing.
I think it's worth pointing out too that a lot of China's subsidy is debt based. They have tons of debt relative to the rest of the world, and that works really well in this inflationary environment that we're in the global economy. But if the scales start to tip at all whatsoever towards Bitcoin, which I think all of us believe that it will, debt quickly becomes impossible to manage, especially expanding debt, because deflation in a debt scenario is very difficult for governments that are used to spending more than they have. And like you said, in terms of the Communist Party and their ability or their mismanagement of their energy infrastructure, you know, you see the same thing in the West. You see the same thing in just about every country in the world. And the reason is because democracy or really any form of government at the federal level doesn't scale well enough. These individuals that run these organizations, that run federal governments, that run, you know, communist parties or whatever, they don't have enough information to make these economic decisions at scale unless they're smart enough individuals in those positions of power to delegate authority And they just so happen to choose people who have the knowledge to make those decisions. You know, if Donald Trump brings Patriots Steve Barbour and Saifedean onto his Economic and Energy Policy Council, and they get a Bitcoin accumulation program going, that might shift the winds for the United States. But I don't see that happening. I see more mismanagement of resources in the future.
Yeah, I mean, also turning to like sort of this management of resources and how this is playing out between nations, how does Bretton Woods, a potential Bretton Woods 2.0 play into this? And is Bitcoin a piece of that puzzle? And who are the players at that table that would roll that out? And are their interests aligned?
This might be an unpopular opinion, but I think it's too late for that. Mm. I think that the social contract of money has been long broken. I mean, and you look at like, if you ask somebody what the number one problem in the West is right now, a lot of people would tell you a lot of different things. They'd tell you wealth disparity. They'd tell you inflation. They'd tell you racism. They'd tell you all kinds of different things. But I think that the number one problem in the West right now is the destruction of trust, the erosion of trust in public institutions. You know, you're seeing it all across the board. You're seeing it in the media. You're seeing it with politicians. You're seeing it with central banking. And like, if you don't believe me, just go look at Twitter. Like, look at the shitstorm that is Twitter. Whenever one of these like blue checkmark public institutions posts anything about anything, the majority of the comments are either mocking them or hating on them or calling out their nonsense policy. And that's a widespread erosion of trust. And you kind of need trust in institutions in order for society to function, at least one that acts in the way that ours does. And that's generally why I think a lot of anarcho-capitalists like the trust that comes with economic activity, because the marker of trust in the free market is profit, right? So you know which institutions are performing in terms of what the market is demanding, because they're the ones making the money. And you can't really have that in this paradigm that we have now, where all of these institutions are funded by the government or subsidized by the government or propped up by bad business, zombie companies, cheap credit. All this stuff is just nonsense, and it has to collapse.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I really like the way you put that. And it's trust is broken. And I think that's why I have a hard time wrapping my head around what they would roll out for Bretton Woods 2.0, because I don't think I'd buy it. And from what I'm hearing, you know, not a lot of people would buy it. I'm kind of curious, though, like, how does Bitcoin bring trust back to the people and away from institutions?
Well, that's kind of its whole job, right? Mm. Like that's what makes Bitcoin different, is that you don't have to trust it. You verify. Like you simply know it is or it isn't. And it's not a set of rules based on some politician or some political party or that the media agrees with it. It's a mathematical set of rules. If you have the keys, you're the owner. And what's funny is that you actually talk about Mr. Clown. you talk about how like profit is actually a measure of trust for like who's producing or creating real value in the market. Is that that's actually funny, because I never quite put it in the realm of trust, but you're actually right. I just read Atlas Shrugged again very recently, when Valis was doing the book club episode on Atlas Shrugged, and God, that thing is a beast. But there's a part.
I have a question, Guy. Did you skip the 100 or so pages of strange love triangle?
No, I stayed hard through the whole thing, start to finish. but I actually had forgotten about like the shift in the love story in the quote unquote third section, and I was like, oh shit, that's right, it changes again. So it kind of took me a little bit for left field. But it's been a really long time since I read it. But one of the things that she harps on kind of in the philosophy is that profit in a free market with real money is actually proof based on the legitimate agreement with other people, the actual cooperation with other people in the market, that you did something that was worthwhile, that that from start to finish, you worked your butt off, and at the end of the day, you created more value instead of destroying it. And that is a sense of trust, and that's what's completely broken down. If you can get debt that is completely meaningless and has no market price whatsoever, and you can buy your own stock for the price to go up, you have like that whole relationship is just completely obliterated. And that's how you get the corruption and the bastardization of quote unquote capitalism, is that people just create projects for the sake of chasing cheap money, and profit becomes completely detached from actually producing something of real value. And all of it breaks down. But I think a lot of it too is just in the lack of cohesion in like a political narrative, like it's something that the internet has done to media, that it basically has done. It's disrupted so many different industries and so many different like legacy structures of things. It's also done this same thing to political narratives. And there was this kind of cohesive, joint lie that we always told ourselves, through the, you know, three major media networks, and now it's just splintered into 1,000 pieces. And that's kind of exposed all of these other problems that have been exacerbated over the same period of like 2 or 3 decades. And everything's coming to a head at once. Like, it feels like extremely fourth turning-esque. And like, I think the next 10 years, it just, so much is in flux right now. Like to see the financial system, the massive global debts across so much of the modern world, the narrative political breakdown of incumbent media and kind of the old legacy systems, and Bitcoin all coming to head at the exact same time, it just screams that at the end of this decade, the world is just not going to look like where we are sitting right now.
So I actually have a question, and I have thoughts on this for myself, but I want to know what you guys think, particularly you, Pierre. What else do you guys think Bitcoin will disrupt besides money, right? Because we talk about the money a lot, but the potential of Bitcoin to disrupt a lot of other industries is very real. What are you guys most excited about, or where do you think that Bitcoin will be the most disruptive outside of just economically?
Yeah, so outside of just economically, okay, that's a big caveat. I would say outside of just monetarily, right? Because I think that Bitcoin's potential to disrupt things like insurance even is far more significant than we're aware of just yet. Because I think that a lot of insurance emerged out of necessity due to inflationary cash, where we can't just self-insure by holding cash. And so then we have to outsource it to insurance companies that fundamentally now are just, you know, professional investment managers. And so basically what they're saying is that they're going to manage a portfolio of assets such that they get a high enough return that they're going to be able to pay out on all the policyholders eventually. So there's insurance, but if we go zoom out even more outside of the economy, I think it does get to that question of trust and verification, where and this is something that I think is a bit of a swing back. That is that in the 20th century, we swung very far in the direction of relativism, where we rejected the notion of there being absolute truths. And we kind of held ourselves to be so intelligent that we can actually discover the fundamental, not only can we discover fundamental realities, but that also that these realities would be opposed to each other, right? And this is kind of where we went with the whole quantum stuff. And I don't want to speak to that, because I think that there's kind of, it's only symptomatic of a wider trend in society towards relativism. And I think that especially in the moral universe, I think that we took what we learned in the world of physics about relativity, and for a number of different reasons, we decided to apply it to the moral universe, where I think that it ultimately actually had no business being applied at all. And we could argue that the main catalyst for why that happened was because of fiat money. Because ultimately what fiat does is it corrupts the political system, and thus I think it corrupts the moral fabric of society. So if we were to assign the root cause of moral relativism to fiat, and the reason I do that is because I think that actually fiat was uniquely enabled by where we were in our technological progress, in that paper technology had advanced to such a state that we were able to make $100 bills that cost more than $100 to, you know, counterfeit at scale, and simultaneously not have the technology that enables Bitcoin, right? Or not have discovered the Bitcoin technology, let's say. Because I think that in hindsight, we'll talk about Bitcoin technology the same way we talk about paper technology, as kind of just generic category. And so we were kind of in a unique place in the world where we were between gold and Bitcoin, and we were with paper. And this created such a tremendous concentration of power that it did actually corrupt the politics and the moral fabric of society itself. That's my hypothesis, and I think that that gets pretty close to kind of Seyfiedean's hypothesis. And the reason that it tears apart the moral fabric itself is because the moment that you have a monetary system that has, first of all, that concentration of power, but also the second of all, the desire of that power to manipulate people's time preference. And that is really something that's kind of uniquely tied into democracy, where we want everyone to have the highest time preference possible. Politicians want everyone to have the highest time preference possible, right? In order to get reelected every 4 years. So it creates a time horizon for humanity of 4 years, when, you know, that's a very short amount of time. That's kind of ridiculous. I would argue that humans should generally think about either like days, months, let's say, a year, or 5, 30 years, right? And really have kind of ultimately their long-term expectations should be multi-decade. In the world of accounting, if we kind of just take that as a kind of a glimpse into human psychology, anything longer than 1 year is considered long term, which I find to be really absurd. So I think that so Bitcoin's going to fix the time preference issue, but I actually think the pendulum is going to swing even further than it was under gold. I think that because of gold's very soft difficulty adjustments and its lack of halvings, it has kind of a, let's call it a 3% dilution rate, whereas Bitcoin has a 0% dilution rate, right? If we look at 21 million Bitcoin. So I do think that time preference is going to go even lower than it was under gold. And so I think that the moral fabric of society will be strengthened even further than it was under gold. And there's going to be a lot of really interesting repercussions, and ultimately to the benefit of humanity, because I do think that morality is a really important part of human flourishing, and that the more we promote immorality, the more miserable people are. And that to me is reflected in, especially, you know, with this coronavirus thing, right? Where people are talking about, oh, you know, depression and suicide are skyrocketing. I see depression and suicide as to me they're part of this cluster of psychological problems caused by high temp reference, along with anxiety as well, obviously. And so I think that Bitcoin is going to be good for our mental health. It's going to be good for the moral health, you know, which you could kind of say is the collective mental health of society. And ultimately, that'll trickle into our economics, into our politics, right? Where I think our politics is reaching, in the U.S., levels of, it's weird too, because we have so little to disagree over that now we disagree over like Goya beans being, you know, Republican or Democrat. Like we've run out of things to disagree over, right? We've taken care of really, you know, the biggest moral question in the United States was slavery and the racial issue. And I think that, you know, after having a black president, there was kind of this void of what is our moral duty now, and what do we need to change to improve ourselves? And really, we don't want to look at the hard part, which is the Federal Reserve. So everyone's ignoring that, and instead we focus on things like George Floyd counterfeiting money, right? Instead of looking at Jeremy Powell counterfeiting money.
That $20 bill was really what tipped it over the edge.
Yeah.
That was the nail in the coffin.
It was. And that would not have happened with BTC Pay Server. You know, they wouldn't have had that issue.
It happened on my BTC Pay Server. Mine's solid.
Yeah, exactly. So it automatically verifies the authenticity of the Bitcoin as it comes in. And you don't have to call the police. But yeah, anyway, I think that it's overall, and I think that it's coming at the right time, because the fiat system had kind of played itself out. Once you get down to, you know, the 0%, the zero bound, you've really squeezed all of the juice out of the fiat system. And now you have diminishing marginal returns, where I think any, additional steps in that direction are just going to be purely inflationary and aren't going to really even provide short-term growth.
Yeah. One thing on that kind of makes me curious is that, like, I've thought for a while that, like, we've been in a horrible financial situation for a long time now, like 15 years, like, really, like, it's just been a complete mess. And I half wonder if Bitcoin had been 12 or 13 years old in 2008. I wonder if they'd been able to actually reflate it. I wonder if it was actually a significant consequence of the lack of an escape valve that allowed them to reinflate this thing for a whole nother decade. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. It's just me musing about this stuff.
Yeah. So that's a fair observation. My bias is always towards Bitcoin being a really endogenous process. And so that's where I do think that the U.S. election is irrelevant, but I also think that the macro cycle itself is irrelevant with regards to Bitcoin's value accrual, and that ultimately it's going to be Bitcoin that causes a crisis rather than us turning to Bitcoin in the midst of a crisis.
Yeah, that's interesting, is that the actual movement into it is what causes the unraveling. On a point you were talking about with the moral breakdown, the breakdown of the moral fabric of society, I totally agree. Because there's actually multiple ways in which I think the manipulation or the corruption of money really feeds on that problem. The one that you pointed out that I think is just absolutely spot on is that everything becomes it moves to the political frame of time, is that whatever happens with money or finance or debt or whatever is just for this political election. Like, and now we have to shift for the next regime or for the next Senate. And so everything becomes ultimate high time preference. But just inflation in general, I think it was Breedlove that had this analogy, was that like inflation is something that forces businesses, you know, it's forcing businesses to increase their prices as their costs increase. And they want to do the opposite, right? They're trying to compete to not increase their prices faster than their competition, which actually puts them at odds with their consumers. Their consumers become an enemy, an adversary, rather than somebody who is a good business relationship. Because what they now need to do, he used the example of wine, was that they're now encouraged to water down their wine and not tell their customer that they've done so, so that they can keep their prices the same as their customers expect them to be, which makes what should be a trusted, healthy, long-term relationship into one that's adversarial. While at the same time, just in a general sense of financial irresponsibility, going into debt, buying loans that you can't afford, it destroys the feedback mechanism. Inflation and being able to manipulate the interest rates rewards the people that that go into too much debt, that are consuming resources instead of actually producing them. And in the flip side, disconnects the fact that personal sacrifice and frugalism actually gets personal gain. It punishes those people to pay for the irresponsible ones. So across the board, it's like, why was I ever frugal? Why did I take this personal sacrifice? Why, when my neighbor took out nothing but government loans to send their kids to college, and then also took out a loan to buy the house and buy two new fancy cars, and I worked my ass off on two jobs, paid their way through college, and now somehow they are in a better financial situation than I am? Like, why did I ever do the right thing? Why didn't I just do what they did? It destroys freaking everything. It's so poisonous on so many different levels. And it's a feedback loop. The worse it gets, the worse it gets. Like, the more it accelerates to people being like, oh, my grandparents were the frugal ones. They were the ones like, well, you 90 years old? Just get a credit card.
Well, this might be where we see the shift, right? Because it's interesting. If you're the frugal one now, well, then you're in the position like you know, our boy Michael Saylor, and you're in the position to, you know, you have positive cash flow, and then you're sitting on all this cash, and you've saved and not over leveraged your business capital. Well, now suddenly you can take a $500 million position in Bitcoin.
And rewarded by orders of magnitude. It's like all the pent up failed incentive is now being flooded. It's like 10x, 100x what was missing in the last like five decades.
Well,
it's like
all the pendulum's point. It's got to swing back, right? I mean, it's swung so far. Oh, it's like Pierre said. I'm guessing when Pierre you said that in a lot of cases, in terms of long term and accounting, is accounted for after a year. My guess is that would largely be because of the tax structure, because of capital gains. You know, after 1 year, it's considered long-term capital gain. And, you know, interestingly, in a society where everyone is forced into equities, particularly in their 401ks, in order to try to preserve their wealth, we have a hyper awareness of accounting, which, no offense to you, Pierre, but really isn't an interesting topic to most people. So they have this hyper awareness to accounting, focusing on, you know, like quarterly results and annual results, and then distributing their capital appropriately based on companies that are producing, you know, quarterly returns that may or may not be sustainable. But this hyper awareness is sort of like a promotion of this high time preference activity of investing to preserve wealth from the fiat money, which is erasing all of the productivity of the workers.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it goes back to Guy's earlier remarks about how inflation pits the producers against the consumers. And it's also true in the accounting world, where inflation actually does pit the accountants against management, and also the accountants against the shareholders and the management's against shareholder. Shareholders should have a long-term view on their investment. And I think that Bitcoin's going to change that, because now you won't necessarily have to own stocks in order to keep up with inflation, or you won't have to. You'll just own Bitcoin. And so if you remove that pressure for people to own equities as a short-term liquidity store of value, then it allows management to think longer term and to be okay with. Because here's the thing is, we know this as Bitcoiners, is that 80% drawdowns are good, right? There's nothing inherently wrong. Sorry, not necessarily good, but there's nothing inherently wrong with an 80% drawdown if it means that the price went up a lot, right? Or if it means that there are long-term structural reasons for why the price is down this much, but that ultimately, if you're an accumulator and if you're someone who is building up your capital base, large drawdowns are an opportunity. And I think that because people use the stock market as short-term liquidity, that large drawdowns are now, you know, scary, right? Because, hey, you needed that money like in 6 months. and really the stock market, in my mind, it should only have insiders trading, right? Because as an outsider, you don't know anything. I don't know why you would be involved with the stock market at all as an outsider, unless it's that you are being pushed into it by inflation.
Yeah, interestingly, you're prevented from doing, well, the majority of people are prevented from doing because of accredited investor laws.
It's perverse. Yeah.
It's so backwards 100 different ways. Your question, though, I wanted to answer that question you asked to Pierre a little bit ago about what else will Bitcoin disrupt. He said insurance is definitely on my docket for like waiting to really see something amazing come out programmatically. And maybe that's a tap script kind of future. The idea of like being able to like get into a pool that has explicit controls and exits to, a group of people paying into it. I think there will be quote unquote decentralized or very loose versions of insurance that will completely make the current model look ridiculous. But one thing that I think is really discounted or not focused on sharply enough is legal and judicial, particularly civil courts, business contracting and dispute resolution. Is that I cannot see, like, when you can have a business arrangement that you attach the money to with a couple of extra keys that are explicitly prior to entering an arrangement where you have sent somebody money over, and then it holds for like a 6 month period or whatever as the arrangement between you and your other business and this other business unfold, that there is literally an arbiter that holds a key to whether or not that goes back or, you know, those business requirements are met. I think civil courts are going to get obliterated, and they are something that is like just so horrifically inefficient that they are so primed for disruption. Our judicial system is a freaking nightmare. It's awful every way you could possibly think about how it's all. It's messy. It's corrupt. It's so fucking slow, and it's expensive in every possible way that it can be expensive. To be able to resolve, business needs to operate. To be able to resolve something in a couple of days versus a year and a half is a godlike power when you're talking about a competitive market, where you can just be done with something, settle it, and keep rolling and like move forward. And to shrink your legal team. Like, I think that's going to be a huge thing. I think dispute resolution, writing complex contracts, having explicit arrangements with some subset of arbiters. I think there will be a whole new market for arbitration that is not at all the judicial system that we think of it as today. And legal and judicial structures are going to change massively in the next decade.
Well, I think that kind of falls into the insurance thing too, because...
Oh, it's very similar. Yeah.
Really, as long as you can find liquidity on the other end, as long as you have an arbiter, I mean, you could technically, now that we can theoretically exist in this cyberspace that doesn't have that, that's not held down by the legislation, if you will, on this permissionless money system. And we're already kind of seeing the baby steps of this with the betting markets that are popping up with Bitcoin, right? Something that probably wouldn't have been possible, or certainly not nearly as frictionless in the legacy financial system. These are essentially rudimentary insurance markets, right? I mean, like if you don't want Joe Biden to win the election because you expect that he's going to raise your taxes and that's going to hit your net worth by 6% or whatever in the following 4 years, well, then you can hedge against that with an insurance contract that pays you out should he win and win back 6% or 7% or whatever the premium is that the arbiter is willing to give you on that contract. And these things are going to be possible with discrete log contracts probably relatively soon.
I was about to say DLCs are basically, I think it's an infrastructure problem, not a coding problem at this point. Because you don't really need a whole lot to make those things work. You just need the businesses, the market, and the liquidity, which is just building out. Like, DLCs are here, you know?
You also, I would caveat that with, you also do need the Bitcoin adoption, because...
Okay, yeah, true. Good point.
But I do agree with you with your points that it's going to be huge, and that it really is a matter of creating the infrastructure at this point. I don't think that there's cryptographic primitives that need to be discovered.
Yeah. It's basically like as soon as businesses are closing deals in Bitcoin, which, you know, there might come a time where as soon as there's any sort of advantage for a business that does, like, let's say MicroStrategy starts doing that, and then they can come up with some sort of arrangement that, you know, saves them money or speeds up some process that they are working in, I think the competitive advantage will roll relatively quickly, but
yeah,
it might just be Bitcoin treasuries, so who knows?
Yeah, I agree. And to me, there's two parts to it. One is that I am interested in it, you know, for the technology, right? But the other part is that I think it sucks the air out of the utility narratives that we see around so many altcoins that are essentially trying to do this, but they're trying to do it with their own shitcoin as the underlying asset. And that's where really we get into a turtle versus the hare race, right? And I think that Bitcoin is the turtle, and that some of these shitcoins are the hare. And so they're going to be able to build out that infrastructure more quickly than Bitcoin. But because ultimately adoption of the underlying asset that is the collateral is the constraint, is the bottleneck, that Bitcoin will emerge as the winner, because Bitcoin is going to emerge as the winner as, you know, the best Bitcoin collateral, as the best treasury reserve asset.
Yeah, it'll be that, like, people think that the contracts are going to give a value to the token when the valuable token is going to be the determining factor as to whether or not anybody gives a shit about the contract.
Precisely, yeah.
Right, you can do your black market death contract settlements in Monero and then immediately convert it to Bitcoin if you really wanted to.
Heavily Armed Clown, what other aspects do you think Bitcoin's going to destroy and maybe in the same framework create? You know,
That kind of touches on what I just said, because, like, you look at some of the musings of the early cyberpunks like Tim May, and he talked a lot about assassination markets and things like that. This just this idea of this unstoppable, uncensorable money that's also programmatic. It opens up this whole can of destabilizing worms for the state in a way where suddenly the incentives become much different, right? Whereas in an inflationary environment where you can control the monetary policy and control the legislature, and to a large extent, maybe not in totality, but to a large extent, control the actions of your populace, you know, you have a lot of centralization of power and you're not at a ton of risk. But when that power spreads itself out and you see less palatable things emerge in this decentralized web of trust, I guess you could call it,
right,
where things like assassination markets, you know, regardless of how you feel about the ethics of that, or like whether or not you would support it or you want it to happen tomorrow, like it doesn't really matter, right? Because we're at this point in the world where these things are happening and they're going to continue to happen, and frankly it can't be stopped. Nobody can censor that transaction or claw that money back or shut it down. There are ways, people will find ways. And if there's demand, that demand will be met with this uncensorable money. And if you're a politician and, you know, let's say you're a politician of a country or even a large state, and someone puts out an assassination contract on your head, well, do you want to run for that reelection? I mean, I wouldn't.
It's interesting. I mean, Bitcoin, I think, also enables free speech just by, you know, baking things into the time chain. But how do you think maybe Bitcoin plays into freeing speech, making it more immutable and uncensorable?
Just F you money in general. Just like just knowing that your capital is not tied to, you know, potentially your reputation or... Like that financial security makes people speak their mind, and there are going to be a lot of really crazy anarchists and libertarians and people who have got into Bitcoin that are just not afraid to push back. And that is what so much of the, I think that's where so much of the political dependency comes from, is that everyone's so dependent in so many aspects of their lives. When you're living paycheck to paycheck, when you have absolutely no savings whatsoever, or God forbid you have thousands of dollars in debt, you can't speak up to your boss when you disagree with their decision. Like you can't challenge a decision with your business. You can't go in and argue with someone about getting a raise, because if you lose your job, you're screwed. Like, your ability to stand up for yourself and what you believe in is directly related to how secure you are financially. And it translates from the business environment to the social environment to the political environment. It's connected across the board. And because of that, we've created a whole series of generations of just dependent, weak, do what I'm told, make sure everybody likes me because I'm on the edge of disaster all the time. And Bitcoin is going to flip that on its head.
Well, and capital is an amplifier of speech, right? I mean, like, regardless of what your views are on natural rights.
Yeah, sure,
and what the legislature says, like on paper, me and Mike Bloomberg, we have the same right to free speech, right? But Mike Bloomberg doesn't get censored on Twitter when he says the wrong thing. And he has a whole media conglomerate that he can use to push out his narratives, right? So, like, yes, technically, according to the law, Mike Bloomberg and I have the same level of free speech, but he enjoys a greater amplification of his voice because of his capital. And capital is an amplification of just about everything, just about every one of your rights. The more capital you have, and maybe that's unjust, right? But what are you going to do about it? You can't change the nature of markets. You can't change the nature of capital allocation.
It's interesting with the amount of capital and the way, you know, these internet and technology companies are accumulating capital. Who do you think is going to have more power in the next 5 years? You know, after 5 years, maybe the internet monopolies or the states? And how does Bitcoin play into this?
I'm hoping that because Bitcoin bootstraps a monetary system, and this monetary system bootstraps a payment system called Lightning, and Lightning bootstraps an identity layer, you know, with your pup keys, And that bootstraps a social layer. And so that ultimately, by this kind of network effect, having a domino effect, that we end up with a far more decentralized layer for the internet, for communications. That's pretty idealistic. I hope that turns out to be true, but I'm also concerned that because network effects are so strong, that it doesn't really matter how bad Facebook and Twitter become in stopping free speech, that they continue to be the centers of the digital world.
I'm kind of curious now, you know, let's turn to tomorrow and the next few months. You know, there might be turmoil and uncertainty. How does that play out for, you know, the markets and Bitcoin? Is it agnostic? Is it bullish times? Is it uncertain for Bitcoin as well? Is there, you know, I'm not looking for projections, but just kind of sentiment.
Well, riders can smash up the windows of the New York Stock Exchange and Wall Street, but riders can't smash up the windows of Bitcoin.
Damn.
Those Bitcoin windows, they're hard. They're tough shit.
Yeah. Good luck.
Yeah, I think the more chaos is around the fiat monetary system, the better Bitcoin looks. So I think that, you know, an extended period of uncertainty about who will be the U.S. president does actually highlight Bitcoin's stability and its political neutrality. But I just think that Bitcoin kind of just runs on its own metronome. So I don't think that it would have a material effect.
Yeah. I really feel like it's winning big tonight. Holding and surging. And I think it's really kind of getting a magnifying glass on it. I just feel a little differently tonight than I did yesterday even about Bitcoin. Not differently, but just more excited. I feel like it's given me freedom to not worry about the political situation. So it's just been empowering for me personally.
That's just it, right? Because at the end of the day, does any of this really matter? I mean, we can pontificate all day long about what events and what macro environments made Bitcoin go up and what events made Bitcoin go down and this and that. But like, at the end of the day, like, did it matter? Maybe. Probably not. Honestly, probably not. I mean, I don't think, like, some of these people that are coming into Bitcoin and taking huge positions with corporate treasury positions, like, are they really doing it because they were afraid that Biden was going to win the election? I don't know. I don't think so. And I don't think that they're positioning themselves based on like a necessarily uncertain immediate future, but more so because they see the trajectory on the long term. And I think that there's a growing number of people that are positioning themselves that way within Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think Bitcoin comes out big out of all of this and a winner in both cases. And I'm just really amped.
I don't think either is bearish for Bitcoin.
Yeah, like, I think clarity is
grow either way.
Yeah, I think just the world and the country are looking for clarity, and I think that's just going to help Bitcoin. I think that, you know, it's kind of like we're all waiting for a paternity test to find out whose daddy's going to be, and I'm glad I'm not I'm not tuned into Maury Povich trying to figure that out. And I've just been so excited, and it's been so dope to chat with you guys on election night and talk Bitcoin. I really appreciate it. I want to open it up if anybody has any going out thoughts.
Bitcoin wins the election in 2020. That's my forecast.
I think that Michael Saylor really won 2020. I've never seen someone go from, you know, 0 to 6 months to understanding Bitcoin better than almost anyone else.
Seriously.
Do you guys think that's because he's coming at it through this lens of 2020 and he's got $500 million in cash, a problem that most people don't have or most entities
that
don't
guy
have.
Took a freaking rocket ship down the rabbit hole.
Right?
Yeah. I think it's his raw intellect. I really do. And that he simultaneously understands monetary economics, finance, accounting, and technology.
Right. What do you think was going on with MicroStrategy, though? Do you think it was a little bit of a Hail Mary pass, you know, for the company?
No, I don't think so. I think that they're like a long-term cash flow positive business. You know, they've been grinding their way up to the amount of assets that they have on their balance sheet over decades. Like they didn't just get rich like in the last 5 years. Like his company's been around for a long time. It knows its purpose. It knows its direction, and he has a voting majority.
Yeah, well, that was huge. That was key. I think that's why he was the first mover, because he had so much control.
Yeah, I found it interesting that he said there was very little pushback with their board, or like their whole crew, essentially, is that they would come together. The way he described it on my podcast was just that they would meet, they would talk about all the stuff that they found, and they would try to work out the differences and like get their individual opinions out. And then they would split up, and then like a month later, they would be like, all right, I found all this stuff, and I read this thing, and I listened to this thing, and they'd do it again. And they did that for like a couple of months. And then everybody was just like, yeah, we should be buying Bitcoin. This is stupid. Like it was just kind of like everybody was on board. It's like, all right. And everybody came to it in their own separate way. But that it really wasn't like the way he tells it, it wasn't really I had to convince everyone. It was just we all went down this road of like, is this a real option here? And does this make sense? And then after a couple of months of really digging into it, everybody was like, yep, this is what we should do.
And it really blew up the merchant's narrative of, well, they need cheap transactions in order to adopt this. Because one of Michael Saylor's points, which isn't really something I'd thought about before hearing him talk about it, is that one way to, if you're selling a product where the person buying the product or service is going to need you, you know, for 10, 20, 30 years, which turns out is a lot of different products, right? It's anything from a house to a car to a piece of software, that you're going to want that company to be around for a long time. And one way for you to have that certainty, or to at least alleviate the uncertainty, is for that company to be holding a lot of Bitcoin. And that to me is the real merchant adoption, is companies saying, hey, we hold 10, 50, 100, $500 million, billion, $5 billion, you know, $10 billion worth of Bitcoin. So you know we're going to be around for a long time. Not even like because we're going to make, you know, short-term capital gains on it, but just as a permanent capital asset that sits on their balance sheet and provides comfort to counterparties, this company is not going anywhere else. And that just didn't exist before. If you look at all the ways that you could have done that before, they're very weak compared to the way Bitcoin does that.
Yeah, I'm just blown away, guys. I've enjoyed this so much. I've never had so much fun on election night.
This sucked. I've hated it.
Oh, man.
Four more years of Bitcoin.
Four more years of Bitcoin. Damn it. Four more years. Damn. I kind of love that is one of those just beautiful things about Bitcoin, right? Is that like I don't know if that was relevant to the political atmosphere, but it just kind of feels like it, that Satoshi was just like a real big old middle finger to the political establishment, that we have halvings like on the same years that we have elections, that say, by the way, Bitcoin is more important than you, and we're disrupting everything, and our money just got harder, while you argue about the same old bullshit day in and day out and pretend that this election is the one that's gonna change everything, when we all know that it's the same freaking story every time, and nothing is gonna change unless we buy Bitcoin and divest from your freaking idiocy.
It's too immaculate, too brilliant, and too much ethics in the way he did it.
It's just a beautiful irony.
Yeah. I'm blown away. I'm so happy that, well, I'm just relieved that we have Bitcoin. I've never been so calm on election night.
I'm just drinking. I feel like I'm just watching a dumpster fire and like I'm waiting to see which color it's painted.
Yeah.
And
I'm having
a wonderful time.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we have Team Bitcoin and I'm glad we have you guys to take us away from all of that. This has been so dope. I brought you guys together. I mean, you guys have all been on the show before. Heavily Armed Clown was, you know, chat number 8, what the fuck happened in 1971. Pierre Richard was number 1, accumulating Bitcoin, libertarianism, anarcho-capitalism. Guy Swan, you were on number 9. Bitcoin is literally called all this shit. And I just thought that bringing you guys together on election night would be so dope, and it definitely was. So I'm glad you guys were right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, and thank you for listening. If you dug the show, please vote with your thumbs and press those 5 stars. That's the best way to spread the word. This is Seth. Peace out.